Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Pat Schlarbaum.
Hi, Susan.
Hi, Pat. Today we'll be joined by Irv Kloss to talk with Leland Searles about a kind of calendar that is new to a lot of us, a phenology calendar. This will lead us to a wide-ranging discussion of the nature around us, and especially with water. It may be solid now, but that's just one part of the story we'll hear. At the end of the program, we'll hear from Brittany Phillips for YSS with Kay Puttock and from Joe Lynch about the studio construction here at the Pantorium.
Now it's time to get started and welcome our first guest, Irv Kloss. Now, thank you for joining us today, Irv.
Thanks, Pat.
Well, I think it would be safe to say that you have been one of the more influential citizens of Story County in concerning water and water quality, from your campaign to create Ada Hayden Heritage Park to being the Soil and Water Conservation Commissioner for Story County, and also your current involvement with the Prairie Rivers RC&D. And maybe you can give us a little interpretation of what RC&D is, but that's why we thought you'd be the ideal person to talk with Leland Searles, a creator of the phenology calendar of the Raccoon River watershed in Des Moines. And can you tell us where the concept of phenology calendar came from?
Well, I'm not sure I can say exactly, but I do know that Aldo Leopold started keeping track of the phenology of nature in his farm north of Baraboo, Wisconsin, as early as the 1920s and 30s. And he kept very careful records. Of course, he was out in the wild most of the time around his farm, and he would record the first day that a flower bloomed in the spring, a certain flower. And in fact, the day he died, he actually recorded in his records the first bloom of the bloodroot.
Oh, my, in the spring.
In the spring, yes. In April, I believe it was. And so it's a practice that he started and has been continued by a lot of people. And in fact, after his death, his daughter Nina continued this practice right up until she died about 2 years ago. And so there's a tremendous record there of the phenology of not only plants, but also of first bird arriving from migratory bird in the spring, the first egg that is laid by a certain species, the first time a frog comes out. You know, I mean, all these things were recorded. And now we can go back and look at these over time and actually see, well, is things changing? And we found that they are. They are changing, and perhaps due to global warming and the advance of this phenology forward.
Right.
Or backward, I guess you'd say.
Well, it established the baseline data from journal entries that is really influencing our views of the climate change that's upon us. And I mentioned a couple things there. Let's first... what is the Prairie Rivers RC&D? What is the RC&D?
Okay. Well, it's the RC&D's part stands for Resource Conservation and Development. And this was a program that was started by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Natural Resources Conservation Service, probably in the 1960s. And what they were interested in doing was to promote rural development and with a resource base to it. And they tried to get RC&Ds organized around the country according to counties. And in Iowa, we had just about every county in Iowa was signed up as an RC&D. And our particular one here in central Iowa is called Prairie Rivers of Iowa, is a composed of six counties.
I see. Well, that's a conservation group that looks at the phenologies. What is the term phenology?
Well, I wouldn't say that our group, the RCND does this, but a lot of other groups are starting to do it. And phenology is really a record of the season.
I see.
And that's pretty much all it means. I didn't look up the etymology of the word, but that's basically what it means.
Well, in all practical purposes, it's a calendar that gives you the initiation when people see the bloodroot hepaticus, when the Canada geese are flying.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And Lee Searles has constructed one for the Raccoon River watershed.
Yeah. And I believe we have Lee ready to include Lee. Good morning, Lee.
Irv, and good morning, Pat.
Hi, Lee.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I was just looking over your calendar from last year, and things really get busy in March, April, and May, don't they?
Yes, they do. It's a little difficult to put in the little insert photographs in those months, isn't it?
Right. And I wrote on mine, I started making entries around my own home here in Ames. I recorded the first turkey vulture last year on March 13th. And that was about a week earlier than what I had noticed them arriving in the past. They usually come in about 25th of March. So that was my first entry in your calendar last year. And then the next day, on the 14th, I saw my first chipmunk in the backyard. So that's kind of how I kept track.
Interesting. I grew up in Decatur County, and very reliably in the 1970s, the first turkey vulture would show up on April 1st there, and that's along the Grand River in that watershed. And I began to notice later that that date was moving backwards, just a couple of days, it seemed like. But statewide, I think the vultures are arriving earlier now, and a March 13th date is not terribly surprising to me. And those bird migrations are one of the biggest pieces of evidence we have that something is afoot, something on the order of climate change.
Right. Yes, and I know of a long-term study that's been going on swallows and tree swallows. We have a project here in Ames, actually, with nest boxes of tree swallows. And that the kind of data that's being collected in those studies is really valuable. I think the one in Ithaca, New York, they have now, over about 20 years, have moved the date for the first egg laying about 10 days on the average. So things are moving backwards, yeah.
Yes, they are. The National Audubon Society is one of the sponsors of the Christmas bird count every year, the winter bird count, and I've been a participant in most recently in Dallas County, Iowa. But they have 40 years of reliable data for most of the North American continent. And one of the trends they see for the winter birds is a tremendous northward shift of the population centers for those, about 200 species of birds. And there again is evidence that something is going on. It's not that we're losing our chickadees or any of our common winter birds. It's that the area of densest population is moving northward.
Right. So that's another aspect of it, is the geographical distribution is changing.
Yes.
And I think this can be seen on mountains, particularly with changes in elevation where birds occur, and even small mammals are moving up in elevation to get to colder climates where they're used to.
Yes. One of the things that happens as these changes take place is that with migrations of birds and also some insects, of course, butterflies, the monarch is the most obvious example. But Irv, I'm sure you're aware that some of the dragonflies are migratory. One of the things that's interesting to look at is how these changes in migration timing match up or don't match up with the food supply of those species. And in some cases, it leaves the migrating life forms unable to find adequate food.
Exactly. And, you know, that's another thing you have to be careful with data from phenologies, is that an individual year does not necessarily mean a big change, because there's lots of variation, and so you have to look at long-term trends. And I remember when I was working on my PhD dissertation in Kansas, I was working on the eastern phoebe, which is an early nester, as you know.
Yes.
And 1 year out of four that I collected data for, they nested, started laying eggs on the 28th of March, which the average date was usually around April 8th. But that particular spring was really warm. But that didn't mean that phoebes are going to start nesting early every year. It's just at that particular year. And the same way with these dragonflies. We had one of the migratory ones is the common green darner. And we had a warm spring 2 years ago, I believe, and golly, they were here in mid-March and already starting to breed. It was amazing.
Wow. You're right that 1 year isn't a good sample, a good predictor of the long-term trend. But the record keeping that goes into phenology is very much ecological and long-term if the records are kept. And it's that long-term information that tells us if there is a trend, such as the changes in the population densities of a particular bird species. And that's why 40 years of data are very useful. And I'm glad the National Audubon has collated all of that information and produced a report on it.
Yeah, that goes back a long way.
Yes.
Hey, tell us a little more about the Raccoon River. And how many people do you have collecting this kind of data over there?
Well, sporadically, there are quite a few people making observations. I'm getting a little bit of that information. There's a handful who are fairly reliable, about six people. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of photographers also, several of whom have contributed to this year's calendar. So there's some pretty good information, especially on birds. So we're getting some good information that is rather specific to the raccoon drainage area. But the calendar itself draws on statewide information and even goes beyond the borders of Iowa a little bit. It's very much an Iowa calendar with a little bit of emphasis on the raccoon watershed as far as the information. The photography in it is entirely within the raccoon watershed.
I see. Yeah, I looked at it, and it definitely is a statewide application to it.
Yeah, it was a very interesting project to work on, and I'll continue it for as far as I can see into the future. And each version of it is going to get better and better. That first year, the 2013 calendar, was sort of a trial run. It had some design issues and things of that sort, software limitations. The 2014 calendar, I had a much better software to work with, and the result is that I could do a lot more as far as putting in smaller photographs and inserting those into each monthly calendar. To highlight some of the information about what was happening. So it's a great improvement, and I look for further improvements for 2015.
Okay. If someone would want to get your calendar, can you tell us where to write to or call?
Well, they could certainly call my cell phone number, which is 515-979-6457, or they could get onto a website that I have, and there's a page on phenology on that website, And so if you think of the windward and leeward sides of an island, as far as the wind blowing, the website is called is www.leewardecology.com.
Okay.
www.leewardecology.com. It's available. I'll just mention that 520 calendars have gone out to the door this year, so it's been very popular.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, wonderful production that you've shared with all of us here. Irv, there's a lot of good things going on in the Raccoon River watershed. What's the comparison here with your work in the Skunk River and the Squaw Creek?
Well, you know, one of the aspects of Raccoon River watershed is that they formed an association made up of people who lived in that watershed several years ago. And as a result of that organization, they have been able to attract some funding to do some work to improve water quality and the land, mm-hmm. soil erosion, those sign of things. We've been a little bit slower here. The Squaw Creek watershed, actually we formed a small coalition of local residents back in around 2001, and we began to collect data through the Isle Water Volunteer Program that the DNR sponsors, and so we've been collecting lots of data on water quality and bacteria in the water for quite some time, but we've not had an opportunity until just recently to formally go out and apply for funding. And so last year, we formed a watershed management authority, and that requires, under Iowa code, to set up a system where all the counties within the watershed, and in here, Squaw Creek has four counties, and there are four towns, including Ames, and then the soil and water districts from each of those four counties. And we went around and asked each one of those entities to sign a 28E agreement. This is a formal legal agreement under the Iowa Code to establish this. So that gave us then the opportunity, and with the leadership of the supervisor in Story County and Leanne Harder, who's the planning director for Story County, we applied for additional funding. And received some of that money this year, and so we just started developing a 20-year plan for Squaw Creek.
Excellent. Some of the trends from the Iowa Water early research has been quite revealing. And the Iowa Water Project is statewide?
Statewide program, all with volunteers. Care was taken in the early days of that program to try to make the data as credible as possible by getting prescribed protocols for each kind of collection of data, and also keeping it fairly simple so that the average person with the little right. training, and they do have to go through training in order to become a volunteer, and with that training then they can go out and sample, and they're allowed to sample as often as they want or as many times as they want, and usually at a specific site.
Oh, I see.
So I have two sites that I've been collecting data on since 2003 here in Ames and on Squaw Creek. And so that's 13 years of data, which is quite good.
And one of those sites is the golf course, the new golf course?
No? I sample above and below it.
Oh, so you
it just turned out that way because the golf course wasn't there before I started. And it wasn't selected that way. It was selected because of the tributary that comes in between those two sites is Whirly Creek. And our intention was to find out what Whirly Creek was contributing to the main stem of the Quaw. So I've been able to trace that, but it turns out that all the data that I've collected, there's very, very little difference between the two sites. They're close enough together, I think, that whatever's in between doesn't contribute much.
I see.
Another thing that you get advanced training for is bacteria, and we're able to analyze for general coliform bacteria as well as E. coli. And E. coli is considered to be a very important indicator for water quality.
And this work, you've centered it, there's a lot of it here in Ames, but up the watershed.
Yes, all the way up to, we have volunteers that go up into Boone County on tributaries like Montgomery Creek and I think it's Prairie Creek. And some of these creeks were not even named on topo maps. We had to give them names because we didn't know. There's one up there that's fairly large called Glacial Creek that we gave a name to.
Well, there's one really important bit of study on bacteria that you did, and I think this would be of great interest to people.
Because I'm in the creek every month, I try to take a monthly sample, not the same date every month, but at least to get a monthly sample. And one of the things that's allowed me to do is to find out when there's a big increase in the level of E. coli, for example. And I think it was 2010 was the first big increase. I mean, there's a background level of E. coli that exists there almost all the time, which I think is too high. Even that background level is in several hundred colonies per 100 mils is the way we express it. And suddenly, after this one episode, the count went way high, so high that I could hardly measure it without dilution. And I reported that to the city, and they were able to find the source of that bacteria. And it required them digging up the sewer line in order to fix it. And then that was 2009. And in 2010, there was another increase, almost the same spot. And that was at the Duff Avenue Bridge area. Well, that turned out to be a break in the sewer line that was caused by the 2010 flood. Sewer lines go under these creeks, and so that big flood caused that erosion of that thing, and a 70-foot length of sewer line actually got washed out. And that was a main sewer line.
And that was something that people in Ames weren't aware of, but they noticed it because Kellogg was torn up, wasn't it?
That was the first one. In the second one, they had to go in and repair that particular line down south of the Boys and Girls Club. And actually, I wasn't the only one that discovered it. There was another group called the Skunk River Navy that was picking up trash on the creek that same weekend and found that break. So it was simultaneously. It's good that people are in the creek looking, because
Absolutely.
That's how you find these things.
Citizen scientists, really, improving our environment. And you mentioned the Skunk River Navy, Jim Colbert's.
Yeah, Jim Colbert started this as a way to get students involved. And Iowa State has a lot of, I've forgotten now what they call them, but the whole dorm floors will be in one major. But these were all biology majors that he organized and ran a number of canoes from the university, from the recreation department, and then walked the creek during low water and pulled the canoes along and fill them up with junk.
Yeah. Yeah, so a recreational activity turns into something of real value.
Right, and he started this on the Skunk River, and they've been doing it now two or three weekends a year in September and October, mm-hmm. Either on the Skunk or on the Squaw Creek.
And, of course, later on this summer we'll mention the Project AWARE that targets watersheds.
Right, right. That's bigger operation.
but it all connects. Right?
Yeah.
It can really be oriented right here to our own Squaw Creek and how we view our watersheds and how citizens can engage and make some improvements. Yes, Lee.
We do some similar things in Polk County with water quality measurements. I've been in on several of those. And one of the interesting things, Irv mentioned the bacteria training that the Iowater program has. They also make available an advanced training in the other life forms that are in the indicators of water quality, So you would be looking for, say, the young of dragonflies and damselflies, certain kinds of beetles and other non-insect arthropods that live in the rivers in Iowa and the streams. Some of those indicate that the water quality is exceptional or mediocre or poor. And so if you understand how to evaluate those and what to look for, they're very important in judging the quality of any given stretch of stream. You go out on a certain point, and it's often a part of an overall water quality monitoring project. Here we have a Polk County, county-wide evaluation day, once in the spring and once in the fall. And those little critters in the water tell us an awful lot about what we need to know about our water quality. And that goes to, well, is the water drinkable? How much cleaning does it need? Here in Polk County in Des Moines, our water supply is taken from the river. And so the connection between water quality and healthy human drinking water is a very close connection. And Des Moines Water Works and others are very interested in maintaining good quality water in order to keep the costs as low as possible and to assure a healthy water supply. And that goes back to phenology, too, because there is a phenology of the river system and the life in it. And so in the springtime, you will find many of those very young, immature insects and other critters in the water. And if you go back and pay attention to when they are maturing and turning into the adult forms, that's all part of the study of phenology. So if you were to visit one site repeatedly over a period of time, and let's say you notice damselfly larvae in the water there, they're typically associated with pretty good quality water. They cannot survive in poor quality water. But if you were to go back and visit and find those damselflies coming out on the vegetation and maturing into adults, and then get a sense over a period of years for how many adults and larvae are present at that spot, then it gives you a sense for long-term phenological changes that are happening in that particular location, the variations in the water quality, and some of the other factors that influence the population levels, how many are around.
And damselflies, dragonflies, a real significant indicator species. Herb, you've expanded your ornithology to the...
I've got an interest in dragonflies in the last several years, and it's been fun to document the dragonfly and damselfly population at Hayden Park, and with my friend Wolf Osterreich, who is really a great naturalist and photographer. He and I have been accumulating data on that order of insects. It's called the Odonata, and we're now up to 54 species in Hayden Park, and the total state list is 115. So we have nearly, not quite half of the state's list.
Keep up the good work. I really want to express my appreciation to Herb Kloss and Leland Searles. Thank you so much for bringing your wealth of knowledge to the community radio.
You're very welcome.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for today's Susan Franzen, together with my co-host Pat Schlarbaum. And we are moving on now to something quite different, and we'll have a little traveling music or a little music break from jazz played by the Roland Story High School Band, appropriately named Riverscape. And then we'll be hearing from Kay Puttock and Brittany Phillips of YSS about an important program there, and with some exciting updates right here at KHOI Studio.
Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm actually here with two board members of KHOI, Kay Puttock and Joe Lynch. And Kay, let's talk to you first. Kay has been is also a reporter for KHOI's Local Talk, and KHOI is running a program called Community Service Appreciation, which is a program which features a community service in our area, and it highlights some of the features of the program, the services they offer, and also even sometimes how to get involved with the program. Mm-hmm. Kay, good morning. Thank you for coming in. This month you're highlighting
YSS, Youth and Shelter Services, and I aired an interview last week with Ruth Buckles, who's involved with a YSS program called AMP, Achieving Maximum Potential. And Ruth happens to be the adoptive mother of the young woman whose interview we're going to air today. The young woman's name is is Brittany Phillips. And it's kind of a shocking story. She was sexually trafficked until she was rescued and finally adopted by Ruth. And so let's just hear her story. I'm here with Brittany Phillips and Roxanne Thompson, and we're going to be talking about one of the services of YSS called the AMP program. I'll introduce Roxanne first. Roxanne, you're a volunteer at KHOI, and you're involved in the YSS AMP program.
Yes, I am. AMP is an acronym for Achieving Maximum Potential, and it's a program that is offered statewide to youth, foster and adoptive youth who are ages 13 and older, to help them be successful as adults.
And our other guest is Brittany Phillips, whom I just met for the first time. And you work at CIT Charters?
Yes, I do.
Well, I'm so glad you could come, Brittany. Would you like to start by just telling us about your work at CIT Charters?
I book transportation on motor coaches for people, and I work in the office.
So, Brittany, can you tell us how you ended up in Ames and how you were or are involved with the AMP program?
I was taken out of my home when I was younger and placed in a group home. And I ran away from there and got forced into human trafficking. And after I was discovered by an undercover police officer, I was then taken back to Iowa and placed into another group home to get counseling. And that is when I met my mother, Ruth. And I had my first foster care placement. And she introduced me to AMP. And AMP helped me open up and tell my story. And since I've been involved in AMP, I've been telling my story and I've been more comfortable with it. AMP's helped me with some college stuff. And things have just grown since I've been with Ruth and been involved in AMP.
Now, this is obviously a very painful topic. You mentioned that you left your home and you were placed in a group home. Would you like to talk a little bit about that? You know, I'm sure whatever your experience is, a lot of other people share it or can identify with it.
When I was younger, like 7, my real dad passed away. And then my mom started dating another guy right after that. And he was very abusive, like physically and sexually and stuff. And so I started getting in trouble because that was my only way of getting out of my home. And then I got a probation officer and I told her what was going on because I felt most comfortable with her telling her. And then she took me out of my home and placed me in a group home to get counseling.
I see. Did your mother, your first mother, your birth mother, know what this guy was doing?
Yes, she knew.
And she just let it go on?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you mentioned you ran away from your first group home. Would you like to talk about that? And how old were you, for example, at that point?
When I was in the group home, I was 14, and I ran away from there with another girl, and we went to her parents' house in Cedar Rapids. Her dad there was really abusive, and he was doing drugs and stuff, too.
So it's out of the frying pan into the fire. Mm-hmm. Oh.
And so I left there and went on my own and was walking around a Hy-Vee in Cedar Rapids looking for food because I hadn't eaten in a while. And another guy approached me and told me how beautiful I was and that he'd offer me a modeling job. And I took it because I didn't know what else to do and I was hungry. And so I went with him.
Can I just interrupt a second? Is this a typical line that these traffickers use?
Yes.
So they come up to young women and they say, you're very beautiful, would you like a modeling job? And they obviously are good at zeroing in on people who are in pretty desperate straits.
And what age were you again, Brittany?
14.
It sounds from the way you're talking about it that you didn't really believe this guy, but you had no other option. Would that about be accurate?
Yeah.
Yeah. From the people you got to know since you've been involved in advocacy, would you say that, I mean, do you know other people who were approached with exactly that kind of line?
My mom knows other kids because other kids come to her and tell her, but I haven't really myself talked to other people.
So you think this is a pretty typical situation?
Yes.
And one of the things we try to do in the AMP program is to share information so that the same thing doesn't happen to other youth. And I know Brittany and her mother, Ruth, have been involved in doing that.
With that thought, Brittany, could you tell other people who are sort of involved, might be involved in your situation, in other words, they're in a difficult situation at home or in their foster home or anywhere at some point in their life, what would you tell other young women to watch out for and what would you advise them to do when they're in a desperate situation? Don't talk to guys that offer you a modeling job. Where should they go instead?
They should turn around and walk away.
And then, but who should they appeal to? Where can they go?
You could talk to a police officer. You could find someone that you feel safe talking to or that you're comfortable talking to. If it's someone that's involved in AMP, you can talk to my mom. You can talk to Roxanne or Terry. Any of the adults that are involved in AMP are very safe people to talk to. You could, I guess, go talk to a police officer and tell them what's going on with you. I know if there's a human trafficking hotline.
Are there other safety hints that you can offer youth? Ruth just did some training to our AMP youth in Ames, and I'm sure she told them, do not go places by yourself.
Yeah.
Do not hang around in the malls, because that's a huge target for the traffickers.
Yeah. And I've heard bus stations, too. They see kids getting off bus stations where they've run away.
On bus station, I've had to ride that alone by myself, and I've seen some things that looked very suspicious that human trafficking could be involved there.
She just had to be super brave, and I forget how you escape.
While I got transported and taken from Cedar Rapids to Chicago, and they took me to a bunch of different places. And the last place I ended up at was a hotel. And while I was there, they took pictures of me and posted it on Craigslist and did all the stuff
you
they gave me.
Compromising pictures of you?
Yes.
Yes.
And they gave me a cell phone for when buyers would call. And one of the phone calls, I ended up getting lucky, and it was me that got the phone call. And the guy came in, and he posed as a buyer, and it ended up being an undercover police officer. And he arrested me and took me back to the Cook County Police Department. And he questioned me and then found out how old I was and that I was a runaway from Iowa. And he got in contact with my sister, who brought me back to Iowa.
So that was lucky.
That was very lucky.
So you thought he was a customer. And he was an undercover officer.
Well, you know, one word in that story, that shouldn't be called arresting. That should be called rescuing.
Well, that is an issue, isn't it? They have the only way, or you can explain this, isn't the only way that human trafficked people can be helped is for them to be charged with, like, prostitution or something?
Yes. And
which doesn't seem fair.
No, so aren't we working on...
It doesn't seem fair, but even, like, if an officer is going to go into a situation where a girl's being human trafficked and try to rescue her, that girl's going to be in danger when she's leaving. If he goes in to arrest her, in my opinion, then all the people who are human trafficking her, all the pimps and all his other people know, like, oh, that girl's arrested, she's in jail. They're not going to be thinking that she's out of jail all the time.
Oh, I think being safer for the people who are being... Yeah, yeah.
Well, thinking of it from that angle makes sense.
This is just horrendous.
Isn't it? When Ruth shared this information with the AMP youth about a month ago, it was almost... I just felt like I would be so scared if I was your age, but you have to be.
Well, I am just lost in admiration, Brittany, that you have managed to achieve so much already, such a young person, with all these things you've had going against you. This is what sounds to me like a horrendous start in life. So it's very impressive. You speak out about this a lot.
Yes.
That's very admirable. Well, I know you've got to get to work, Brittany, and it was very kind of you to come in so early in the morning to make this recording, and I don't want you to be in a rush with the snow on the ground and everything. So I want to thank you so much for coming in and talking to us and sharing what must be, I'm sure, a very difficult thing to talk about. So thank you again.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're certainly very welcome indeed.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we were just listening to an interview with Brittany Phillips, who was a victim of child slavery. She was interviewed by Kay Puttock and Roxanne Thompson. Kay is our KHOI reporter who is running a program called Community Service Appreciation, where we feature a community service every month, and this month we're featuring YSS, and Brittany spoke about the group homes that YSS has and the youth empowerment group called AMP. During the month, we feature a few interviews with people from these various services, as well as running public service announcements for them. Kay, I think we have one more interview that will air later this month. What will that feature?
Yeah, it's another YSS organization called GRIP. I forget exactly at the moment what that stands for, but it's a mentoring program that's run within the schools. So it helps detect troubles like Brittany had before she ran away from home, in other words, where it can do that. Of course, it does a lot more, too, so that's coming up.
Well, thank you for that interview, and thank you to Roxanne as well for the interview. It's really always really shocking to hear about child slavery and her story. Even though I know it exists, it's a terrible thing to hear about. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I would like to add that since I did that interview, Brittany Phillips has received a Distinguished Service Award from YSS and from the Attorney General's Office. And, quote, recognized for her courage after transitioning from a trafficking victim at age 15 to a survivor and a statewide spokesperson in the fight against human trafficking.
Thank you, Kay, for joining us and giving us our update on the community service. And we have a few minutes left for that in our show today. And in that time, I'd like to turn to our other board member, Joe Lynch. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Ursula.
So, Joe, you are the project manager for building our studios here at KHOI, and we are so excited about it that we wanted to talk about it for a few minutes on the air and bring the rest of our KHOI family up to speed on the exciting things that are happening. We really want to share this with you. We are building our broadcast studios after a year and a half of going on the air, and Joe is the manager of the project. Joe, tell us what's going on.
Project manager sounds very formal. I guarantee you I have my work clothes on. We've been working on designing and getting the materials together and making the decisions necessary to come up with a really high-quality broadcast studio for 8 or 10 months, really.
Yeah.
And it's been quite a fun process.
By committee.
Yeah. And it's worked. I've been very happy with it. Anyway, we
should say that the actual design in the end was done by an architect named Eric Bating, who was employed by Integrity Construction, who paid for the design.
He did a wonderful job of helping us over the hump of getting a final floor plan that looked like it will meet our needs. And now that we have the last 2 weekends, we've spent putting up the framework, the framing for the studios. We have a larger broadcast studio and 2 smaller recording studios. And now you can see the spaces if you come down to the KHOI, and you'll be truly impressed with what you're going to be able to use here in the future.
So the design, we had the design, now we actually see the rooms because the structure, the skeleton for the walls are up. How do you think it looks in comparison to what it looked like on paper?
What's better? It's because it's hard to, unless you're really experienced, it's hard to visualize from paper to actual walls. But it looks great. The spaces are big enough to be really useful, and I'm convinced it's going to work well for us.
How many rooms are there?
3, a larger broadcast studio where we will do what we're doing right now, and 2 smaller recording studios.
Actually, it's 4 because those 3 rooms, by default, make a 4th room in the back for our operator.
Right. Correct.
Right. Yeah. So who is doing this? Who's making the studios?
We hired a framing carpenter. The name of Doug Clark. He's done a great job for us. And, of course, we've had several volunteers. We had 4 of us in there yesterday. And we worked on it last weekend in the cold as well.
Would you welcome more volunteers?
Starting late this week, we will have gathered together the sound isolating materials we need to build a high-quality sound studio. And we'll start insulating and sound isolating. And if you stand too still around the studio here this week, you'll get acoustical caulking spread on you, I'm sure. So you need to be careful where you're going. We're going to use a lot of that stuff here in the next week or so. But anyway, starting this Wednesday or Thursday, we'll wade into the sheetrock and the sound clips. And we're going to be putting up, you know, some 70 or 80 pieces of 5/8-inch thick sheetrock and lots of green glue and all these things that make for a really high-quality sound studio.
Where exactly is the studio?
It's in the back half of our office building downtown, the old Pantorium. We've built it inside the room that has a 12-foot ceiling. Leaves us a room with an 8-foot ceiling and storage space and access to heating and cooling equipment on top. And gives us the room we need to get around and get in and out of soundproof doors and build windows and all those things that need to be done.
What would you say is the hardest thing about building this studio?
Well, none of it feels really hard to me right now. Getting started is probably the hardest part.
Deciding on what to do, right?
Exactly.
What is the most fun part of it?
Working with people that enjoy the process.
Mm-hmm. So you're finding it to be an enjoyable process?
Oh, absolutely.
Is this something that a listener could come and look at?
Sure. Starting, I would say, tomorrow, I would be willing to let anybody who wants to take a peek to look around.
Okay, great. Well, very exciting. We're moving forward. We also thank you to all of you who are listening. We had a successful fund drive. We raised about $30,000 between October and January 1st. And so we are moving ahead. Those funds pay for operations, but they do allow us to feel confident in moving forward. So we are building our studios, and thank you to Integrity Construction for giving us a beautiful design, and thank you, Joe, for what you do. And
to all the other people who've pitched in over the last 7 or 8 months.
Yeah. Well, it's time to close up, so I'll thank you both, Joe and Kay, for coming in. Both Joe and Kay are board members for KHOI and have been involved not only with planning but raising the money for this and just seeing the vision through, and really appreciate your service. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I'm Ursula Rudenberg, but really Susan Franson and Pat Schlarbaum were primarily your hosts today, and they were joined by Irv Kloss and Leland Searles, and they were talking about a kind of calendar that's new to all of us, to a lot of us. It's a phenology calendar of studying the seasons by natural phenomenon. And while they were talking, I was thinking, you know, right now we're broadcasting in the storefront window of KHOI, and there's a kind of phenology that I've learned to observe as the season changes when the sun rises, because we broadcast right at sunrise. And I've been watching, today you can't see anything because it's cloudy, but watching the sunrise on the octagon across the street. It happens earlier. And also it's the movement of animals. And so I have to say, Craig didn't come out of his door today. He usually comes out. So Craig is our neighbor, and he always goes to work at 10 minutes till 7. And at the end of the program, we heard from Brittany Phillips from YSS and Joe Lynch about the studio construction at the Pantorium. You can find more information about the phenology calendar on our website, khoyfm.org, where we will be posting this Local Talk story, the audio from it. Reporters that contributed to today's show were Kay Patak, and Local Talk is engineered by Rick Morrison and Becca Brown. The music you have heard included Riverscape, played by the Roland Story High School Band. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You can listen to this show again and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoyfm.org. That's khoyfm.org, and you can see listings of our past guests and resource contact information. You will find lists of our guests and contact information of the organizations we speak with. And if you enjoyed this show, please tell your friends. And great new possibilities will open to us in the near future when our studios are built. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join our team, you are most welcome. We will train you, and please contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or just come down to the Ames Pantorium at 410 Douglas in Ames. If you have an announcement for our community calendar, email khoynews@gmail.com, khoynews@gmail.com. As always, your participation as audience is what makes Local Talk and KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.